From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you're a science reporter like Donald McNeil and you cover plagues and pestilences, you've got to be careful about conveying just how serious something like the Zika virus is and yet not create a panic. You've got to be able to sift through the conspiracy theories and crappy science because, he says, every new disease rides a wave of rumors. In his book, McNeil lays out the facts about the Zika virus, where it came from, how it went unnoticed for decades and then emerged last year as a growing epidemic. McNeil will join us today. He says there are hundreds of obscure viruses in the world, and every once in a while, one of them leaps out of obscurity. The question is, why? We're talking about the Zika virus after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a lot of talk about the Zika virus these days for obvious reasons, but Zika isn't new, certainly not to African monkeys. In his book about Zika, the New York Times science reporter Donald G. McNeil Jr. Says that Zika has probably circulated in African monkeys for thousands of years. They've evolved this immunity to it probably, but when another type of monkey, an Asian monkey, came down with Zika in 1947 in a tropical forest in Uganda, that's when scientists first became aware of it. McNeil writes that Zika has come and gone since then, but it hadn't been noticed that much until, of course, Brazil and the terrifying news that Zika was causing birth defects. McNeil has written something of a biography of the Zika virus, where it came from, how it works and spreads, and, of course, the future. His book is Zika, the Emerging Epidemic, and he's joining us today to talk about it. Donald G. McNeil Jr. is a science reporter covering plagues and pestilence for the New York Times, where he started as a copy boy in 1976. And Donald McNeil, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I want to begin by you write about your first hearing about Zika, your first brush with the disease. This was in September of 2015. You say the name had kind of a zing to it. To talk about that initial, I mean, you didn't work on the story much at first. You just sort of heard a bit about it. But talk a little bit about your first sort of introduction to what it might be, this Zika thing.
Okay. It was a PR guy from the University of Texas Medical School in Galveston. And he basically wanted to interview a professor that he knew, and he was at first pitching me a story about dengue or chikungunya. And I said, well, you know, I know these diseases are bad. I know I need to write a big article about them at some point, but I'm kind of busy right now. And he said, well, how about an article about Zika, this new virus that's just come to the Americas? And I'd never heard of it. It had kind of a zingy name, right. Zoloft or, well, any number of other names. And so I said, sure, I'm curious about it. If it's hit this continent, let's, you know, maybe it's the next one. Tell me about it. So we had an interview of about 45 minutes, and I thanked Scott Weaver, who was a professor. And, you know, he sent me a paper he had written talking about what might be the next new emerging viruses in America. Yeah. And Zika was on it, but it was sort of in the also-rans. His first two predictions were Rift Valley fever and Japanese encephalitis, which he thought were going to be bigger breakout diseases. And Zika was kind of in the honorable mention category. Mm-hmm. And so I kept my notes, scribbled, you know, the date on the top of them, stapled them, and put them in my head scratcher pile, which is sort of about a 6-inch pile I have on my desk saying right. Stories I've got to do someday.
Yeah.
And that was the last I thought about it until it was the slow week after Christmas. And I write a sort of weekly health item, and I was looking for something to do. And I saw a news item out of Brazil saying that somebody in the Brazilian health ministry had suggested to women that they try not to have babies. And I'd never seen anything, you know, never heard of that kind of thing coming out of any government except for China with its one-child policy. And it's a shocking thing to say to a nation because carried to its extreme, that's the end of the nation.
Yeah.
If people don't have babies. So I looked into it and there were these horrible cases of microcephaly turning up in the hospitals in northeast Brazil. And so I wrote a very quick thing that day, called the one doctor I knew in Brazil and asked about it. And then I was planning to write a big story the next day, and our Rio bureau chief had interrupted his Christmas vacation to start on it. So we worked on it together, and I've been basically working on Zika ever since.
Yeah. It's interesting, your conversations with, you're working with the CDC, and I want to come back to that. I think that's an interesting part of this story, just the way something like this is presented, how the guidelines work, all of those kinds of things. But let's sort of back up a bit. First of all, let me ask you, in your role, how do you think about the importance of conveying the significance of a plague, of something like a virus, and yet not panicking people? I mean, how have you been able to find that kind of balance?
That's my constant struggle in my job. At what point am I spreading panic, or are others spreading panic, and is it my job to damp it down? And in some cases, when is it my job to spread a little panic? Because, you know, nobody had heard about Zika. It had only been covered in the Brazilian media. And, you know, from everything it looked at, it looked like it was already on the march back then in late December. Mm-hmm. And was likely to head here. And the CDC, when I called them about it, said that they would not be surprised if it followed the same pattern as dengue and chikungunya and came to the United States eventually. And it was moving quite quickly. You could see it hitting other countries. Sort of, you know, northeast Brazil is basically on the equator, so it was moving both north and south from there. But, you know, it was January then, so you figured nothing was going to happen during winter or spring here. But by summertime, you know, the United States was definitely in the path, and there was also the Rio Olympics to think about and things like that. So I started writing about it, thinking I've got to, you know, raising alarm as part of my job, too, when something is coming.
Let's start with the story you tell right up front in the book. This is northeastern Brazil, as you say, about 2 years ago. They start to get these reports of this kind of mysterious disease.
Once a misterioso.
Yeah, exactly. And they thought at first they thought this is dengue, which is dangerous if you get it twice. You know, the second infection, you say, can be pretty bad. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't that, and no one was dying. Talk a little bit about what's going on here, because what's interesting about this part of the story is people kind of didn't think much about it. They kind of stopped worrying because it would just go away.
Right. I mean, they were worried about it because it was mysterious and lots of people were getting it. And it was this rash and bloodshot eyes, low fever. Nobody was hospitalized. Nobody died. People seemed to recover, but they were worried because it was something new. Mm. In the beginning, doctors thought it was mild dengue. They thought it might be parvovirus. They thought it might be Fifth disease, which gives you this sort of slap cheek look. Kids get bright red cheeks from it. Mm. And it didn't turn out to be any of those. And finally, a couple of scientists at a university in northeast Brazil said, hey, it's Zika, this African virus that we haven't seen, except that we know it's been in Micronesia and in French Polynesia in the last few years. So we have no idea how it got to Brazil. And the health minister's reaction was, well, this is good news. We know that Zika is a mild disease, so we have other things to worry about. And, you know, there's still yellow fever. There's still dengue. Still malaria. There was quite an epidemic of dengue going on, and dengue can be quite dangerous. So they were relieved. And it was only in late August, suddenly doctors who were taking care of intensive care units at hospitals in the Northeast, neonatal intensive care units, began to say to each other, hey, I've got five kids with microcephaly in my wards. I've never seen more than one or two in the course of a year before. And the other doctor would say, I've got seven. What's going on? And they started interviewing the mothers and found out that a number of them had this mystery rash 9 months before. And they began to put two and two together. It took quite a while for that. And it wasn't until October that they issued an actual alert saying that something horrible is going on here and we think it's Zika, but we don't have any proof.
You say in the book there are hundreds of obscure viruses in the world, and every once in a while one of them leaps out of obscurity. Do we have a clear sense of, and we'll talk about this as we go, but do we have a clear sense of why it is that all of a sudden one emerges?
No. I mean, why HIV? You can trace it backwards when it happens, but we could sit around worrying about Spondwania virus or Bunyamera virus or Onyongyong virus or Japanese encephalitis or St. Louis encephalitis or any number of encephalituses. Who thought something called West Nile virus would become a problem in the United States? Who thought, we've got a disease, Lyme disease, named after a place in Connecticut. There was no name for it before. Yeah. Things spring out, and it takes a combination of the virus traveling, and it also takes a naive population. And by naive, I mean immunologically naive, people who have absolutely no immunity to a disease, that they have no antibodies to it, so it blasts through them. And that's what's happening with Zika here in the New World. The most famous example of immunologically naive is what happened to the American Indians when the Spanish conquistadors landed. Smallpox killed 80% of the Indians that it touched, and that more than Spanish steel and guns conquered the New World. Mm. Armies just disappeared in front of them.
You you take us back to 1947 when Zika is first discovered in this tropical forest in Uganda. And this is the forest where this research institute was started to test monkeys initially for yellow fever. Say something about this research, because I found this really interesting. This was the late 30s, early 40s, and they were suspending these caged monkeys in this tropical forest. It sounds pretty cruel, I have to say.
In those days, it was considered kind of normal.
Yeah,
even nowadays, we have sentinel animals. We don't usually use monkeys, but there are sentinel chickens in places in the world on the lookout for avian flu and things like that. And now there's a tendency to just go test animals in wet markets, in live markets in Asia and stuff like that. Now, those animals are there to be eaten, so taking a blood sample from them is just, one small step along the way to the slaughterhouse for them. But it's a good way to look for diseases that might be roaming around in the woods where they've been caught. In this case, the colonial authorities did a lot of pretty good tropical medicine. The British, the French, and the Belgians, particularly in Africa, not that they were doing it to be nice to the locals, but because they were trying to keep their own. Well, they were trying to keep their local workforces alive, and they were also trying to keep their own army and administrators alive. So they did lots and lots of research into things like malaria and yellow fever. And then the Rockefeller Foundation, which took a big interest in yellow fever in the early part of that century, they had these monkeys strung up in cages in the treetops at various levels because there are different mosquito populations at different levels. Mm. And they would take the monkeys down, sling them out of the towers, and take their temperatures each day, and then push them back up and graph it. And Rhesus number 766 had a temperature one day, and they decided to see what was up. So they took him out of his cage and took him into the lab and did a blood draw. And that was the beginning of the whole research project. The hard part, and what took years and thousands of mice, was figuring out that it wasn't yellow fever and it wasn't one of dozens of other viruses that had already been named, that it was something new.
Yeah.
And that took a lot of research because there were no electron microscopes. There was no DNA sequencing machine. We didn't know what DNA was. So you had to start from scratch basically by getting the infectious agent out of the blood and then letting the animal recover and getting the antibodies out of the blood and then start matching them off against each other and other animals to see if you give an animal a virus and you give it the antibodies to something else, well, and it doesn't cure it, well, then it's obviously not the same virus. And it took them 5 years before they published the paper describing what they had found in 1947.
How significant was it that this was an Asian monkey, not an African one? As I mentioned in the introduction, you talk about the fact that African monkeys had probably been getting or had Zika. They had an immunity to it. It wasn't much of an issue. Is that a significant point?
Well, most of the monkeys used in research are Asian monkeys, are macaques, that's kind of the standard because the monkeys are pretty well described in the research, and also there was a steadier supply of them than there was from Africa. Mm-hmm. Maybe if they'd strung up African monkeys in the trees, there never would have been any symptoms, but that monkey didn't get very sick. It didn't die. That's where they got the antibodies to test against the virus when they found a way to give the virus to mice. The monkey survived and a lot of other monkeys survived. It's a disease that doesn't hurt monkeys very badly. It's a disease that doesn't hurt humans very badly, except for fetal humans. It is a totally devastating disease to the fetus if a pregnant woman gets it. Doesn't hurt the pregnant woman that much, but it can destroy a fetus's brain.
Yeah. Were the scientists at that time, once Zika had been identified, were they worried about the potential of Zika?
Not so much, because there were a lot of other diseases around, and Zika didn't seem to make anybody very sick. The first time they found it in a human was a 10-year-old girl in Nigeria a few years later, and she also had malaria, and she had other things, and it took them a long time to figure out that what was in her blood besides malaria was Zika. And she recovered completely. And then, you know, the reason it wasn't spotted for many years is because it was such a mild disease, nobody noticed it. And testing for it in those days was a huge, long, month-long process. Nowadays, we have DNA tests, but nobody had bothered to come up with a DNA test. Nobody had bothered to isolate the primers and create the test because it was something that just kind of hung around in the background. Nobody really noticed it. There are isolated samples of Zika virus in blood samples from all over Asia during the 1960s, but these were never major outbreaks and they never had any big consequences. So nobody, you know, you don't get funding when you're worried about things like bird flu and swine flu and stuff like that. Those are the things that attract funding and those are the things that make researchers' names. So nobody focused on Zika until the CDC looked into an outbreak on Yap Island in 2007. And then the French, the Institut Pasteur, looked into an outbreak in French Polynesia in 2013. And those are where most of the papers about it come from, except for the early papers in 1947.
A big question, too, was you mentioned one of them, why wasn't it studied more? And you mentioned that it was rarely diagnosed. It wasn't thought of as important. Also, there was no reliable animal model you mentioned. That made it difficult to study.
To get it to infect mice, they had to passage it through through 17 generations of mouse brains, which means inject it into the mouse, look for a mouse that maybe falls slightly ill, cut out the brain of that mouse, make it into a slurry, inject that into the brain of the next mouse. And only by doing it 17 times did they get something that pretty reliably made mice badly sick. But by that time, you've changed the virus because it's adapted itself to grow in mice brains instead of in humans. In human skin, for example, so it's a slightly different virus. You can still use it, but it was hard to make animal models. I mean, and you can never predict what animal's going to turn out to be the right model. I mean, for flu, we use ferrets. You know, mice don't get flu, but ferrets do. So, working with ferrets is no fun. They're nasty little buggers, and they bite. And but they're the best model for flu. So there's a big ferret laboratory down at the CDC where they do this stuff.
Yeah. The other big question was, why didn't it cause microcephaly before? And I guess that's a question. Did it, in fact, cause microcephaly before?
We don't know.
Yeah.
We just don't know. We don't know if there are any huge outbreaks because they've never been recorded. We know that, millions of people in Brazil have had Zika virus, which means hundreds of thousands of pregnant women have had Zika virus, and we have 1,800 babies with microcephaly, which means that it happens in a minority of cases. We're not sure how small a minority, but we know it's not every child gets microcephaly. So you'd have to have a really big outbreak in order to get a noticeable number of cases of microcephaly, and there's always a certain amount of background incidence of microcephaly anyway. It comes from if the mother gets infected with cytomegalovirus, if she gets infected with Toxoplasmosis gondii, which is the thing that makes doctors tell pregnant women to stay away from cat boxes, mm-hmm. It's a bacteria you can pick up from cat feces. If you get herpes in the middle of a pregnancy, if you get syphilis in the middle of a pregnancy, severe fetal alcohol syndrome, some industrial chemicals can cause microcephaly. I mean, you know, there's a lot of ways you can damage a fetus when it's growing because it's a serious insult to something that's producing new cells every minute. So. It might have done it, and nobody noticed it because they thought it was other causes. Right. And also, what happened in Brazil is lots of mothers were giving birth in hospitals. Right. In lots of parts of the world, especially in Asia, a lot of mothers give birth at home, out of tradition or because they don't trust the hospitals or whatever. In Brazil, even the poor tend to trust the hospitals because they know the babies do better. So that's when you get a whole cluster of cases. If somebody had a baby with microcephaly, if the baby died at home, it would never be recorded. If the baby was born that deformed, they might never have taken it out of the house, and so nobody would have known about it, and it would have just lived out its life, sometimes very brief, sometimes lifelong, but without ever turning up in any official statistics. So, but in Brazil, you had intensive care units with lots of babies. One doctor even described finding 25 born in the last 10 days in a hospital up there, and that's seriously shocking.
You say the Zika virus is like no other. One person from the CDC you talked to said that the more we learn about it, the scarier it gets. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about why. I guess it's the only mosquito-borne virus that as it's called, crosses the placenta.
Right. That steadily crosses the placenta.
Right.
That does it more than in extremely rare cases. And it's also the only mosquito-borne virus that is transmitted sexually, too.
Right.
So that really changes things. I mean, normally your message to people, you know, avoiding mosquito-borne diseases is, you know, wear long sleeves, stay out, you know, wear insect repellent, you know, or move out of the area, move away from the mosquitoes are. But this is a disease that can be transmitted in northern Greenland without a mosquito in 1,000 miles because it can be transmitted sexually. So you have to give people a lot of different messages. And also trying to tell pregnant women that they ought to have their husband, or trying to tell the husbands of pregnant women or the boyfriends of pregnant women that they need to wear condoms in order to have sex with their lives is a very counterintuitive kind of thought, because most people think, who wears condoms with a pregnant woman? You know, the thing I was worried about has already happened.
Yeah.
So this is a tough message to get across to people. It needs a lot of explanation, a lot of careful public education. I mean, you know, unfortunately, not everybody reads the New York Times where we explain it to them simply over and over again.
Right. There are all kinds of viruses. What kind is Zika? Is it flavivirus?
Flavivirus. Meaning yellow. It's from the same family as yellow fever, which is where it got its name.
Dengue is also a form of this, West Nile. How does it work? Because in the book, you say it essentially hijacks the internal machinery of a cell, basically.
Well, that's what all viruses do. Yeah. Viruses get up close to a cell. They have sort of spikes or knobs on their outside that attach to receptors that the cells normally use to do other things like pick up nutrition. They get absorbed into the cell, and then kind of like a commando team breaking into a town and taking over its car factory and redoing the machinery so that it makes bombs, they redo the cell's machinery so that instead of making new cells, it makes more virus. And it makes so much virus that eventually the cell just explodes and those new virus particles go out and attack new cells and do the same thing. And that's how that's what we call being sick. You know, I mean, cold viruses do the same thing.
Right.
So that's not unusual. What's different about this one is that we're not completely sure how it crosses the placenta, although a lot of research has been done in the last few months. But it appears to cross the placenta, get into the fetus, and then home in on the radial glia cells, which are the cells in the developing brain that act kind of like the scaffolding so that the brain grows on. The other neurons, as they're created in the brain, sort of climb along the scaffolding to find their places in the brain. And if you destroy the scaffolding, then the brain never forms. Mm. And a little while ago, I was in Puerto Rico, and a doctor showed me the brain, the ultrasound scan of a baby. And there's a spot in the middle of the brain that's called the germinal matrix, which is sort of the matrix where the new brain cells come from. And he showed me three white spots in it. And he said, those are calcifications. He said, when you get those, you know, that's dead cells. And he said, when you get problems there, that kills a lot of neurons. He said, this baby doesn't have microcephaly, but this is what leads to it as it keeps growing.
Is there some sense that Zika is adapting? One of the questions you raise again that we were talking about, wait a minute, why wasn't there microcephaly before? Or maybe there was, we're not really sure, but it is possible that there wasn't. So is it possible that in some way the Zika virus is this crossing over to the placenta is an adaptation that's troubling?
It's possible, but there's no evidence of it yet.
Yeah.
We can't do human experiments with the old African strain of the virus, of course. Once we get better at animal models, we'll be able to see, you know, if they can steadily produce microcephaly in mice or something like that, then they could test the African virus to see if it will do it. The virus hasn't changed that much genetically. It's changed some. You can tell the difference between the Asian strain and the African strain. But there appears to be cross-protection from one against the other, which suggests that it's not an enormous change. There's actually more difference between different clades of dengue than there is between the two major strains of Zika.
It was interesting, though, you said in Asia and in Africa, there's the people there have an immunity to it. They're not a naive population, I guess, and so they don't really need to worry about it that much. Is that right?
Well, we don't know how widespread the immunity is. Yeah. There hasn't been enough blood testing to know. But the thing that everybody was worried that the virus would circle the globe and that, you know, having changed and spread like crazy in Brazil and everywhere else in Latin America, then it would hop the Pacific, it would now re-hop the Atlantic or hop the Atlantic and get back into Africa and cause a giant outbreak there where the health systems are far more broken down than they are in South America. In fact, it didn't do that. It got to islands off the coast of Senegal, and a lot of people from those are Portuguese speaking islands, so there was a connection to Brazil, And then those people, the people who live on those islands, often head out to the world through Senegal. But the disease has not spread in Senegal and Africa. So there's an assumption. And we know that Zika exists in Senegal because there was one case of infection in the United States back in 2005-6 from a researcher who had gone to Senegal. And so we're assuming that the African strain is pretty protective, and that if it's not totally widespread, that it's widespread enough so that kids pick it up, you know, out of the hundreds of mosquito bites that kids get while growing up in Africa, many parts of Africa, that, you know, if one or two of them were Zika, that would be protective, but you'd hardly notice it against the background of things like malaria, which is much more dangerous.
Yeah. So the over time, I guess, in this process, the body developed these antibodies. The host recovers, as you say, but the antibodies mm-hmm. stay in the blood for a while, sort of passively yep. protecting, as you say. And then it's like chickenpox.
That's how all infections work. Yeah.
Exactly. And then, but it's like chickenpox. Once you have it, at least as far as we know so far, you shouldn't get it again.
Exactly. Yeah. We don't know if the immunity is lifelong because nobody studied Zika for a lifetime, but it seems to be quite strong. And the islands in the Pacific that had outbreaks, the outbreaks raced through the population, got 76-73% of the population in a matter of months, and then disappeared, and there's never been a case since yeah. on those islands. And the assumption is that everybody who had it once is immune again, and you need enough people who haven't had the disease so that the mosquitoes can kind of spin up an epidemic among them in order to start a new epidemic, and that hasn't happened anywhere yet.
It's interesting. I was noticing in Yap Island in French Polynesia, it seemed like that the course of it was about 6 months. It flared up, and then 6 months later, by 6 months or so, it was gone.
Because so much of the population was and nobody knew whether that would happen in Latin America or not, but it seems to be happening. It seems to have happened in Colombia. Colombia basically declared its epidemic over earlier this month. The epidemic started last October, imported from Brazil, reached a peak back in February, and has now not quite completely disappeared, but there are now so few cases that they've declared it over as a public health problem. They used to be 6,000 cases a week. Now they're down to below 100 cases a week. So it seems like it's following the same pattern on the mainland. In Brazil is such a big country that it's moved around. The disease is no longer in northeast Brazil, but it's moved. It did move down to Rio. It's moved over into the Amazon sections. Since it's an urban disease, it tends – I mean, it's not a totally urban disease, but it tends to concentrate in urban areas because you have a lot of people crowded closely together where the mosquitoes can, you know, infect one person, then another, then another, then another, and you get a lot of virus spreading around. You get a big outbreak, much more so than in a rural area where a mosquito has to fly farther to infect another person.
Donald G. McNeil Jr. is with us. His book is Zika, The Emerging Epidemic. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're tracing the origins of the Zika virus with New York Times science reporter Donald G. McNeil Jr. His book is called Zika, The Emerging Epidemic. He wrote about the fact that people started noticing this virus when it broke out in Brazil last summer, caused rashes and fevers, but no one was dying. And then babies with birth defects started to be born, and it's, of course, making the headlines since. Well, I guess you're used to when you cover these kinds of stories, you're used to the rumors, you're used to the conspiracy theories. And in fact, you say in the book that this is sadly normal, how every disease rides this wave of rumors. And it seems like even though you write about it in the book, they don't seem to go away. This has to drive you crazy as a reporter.
It drives me crazy, but it's completely normal. I'm writing a piece right now about the 1916 polio epidemic in New York City, and I'm researching it, and the same thing is happening. I mean, you know, the blame was placed on the Italians for that one, as the Irish have been blamed for cholera, the Jews have been blamed for tuberculosis. People, you know, thought it was flies. They killed 72,000 dogs in New York City because the rumor went around that little boys were rounding up dogs and bringing them to the police station because they heard the police were paying a bounty. you know, people blamed electricity. They blamed children hunching over in schools. They blamed sunshine. They blamed sunburn. They blamed all sorts of things for polio in those days. And the doctors got it just as wrong. I mean, they were taking kids away from families. They were isolating them in hospitals, often before correctly diagnosing them. They did the diagnosis by spinal puncture, so the kids were going through a horrible pain. It'd come up negative, and then it would turn out that, you know, you'd taken the kid to a polio hospital. It was perfectly healthy, and, you know, now it had polio because it was hanging out with a lot of other kids who had polio. It was a disaster, and a lot of it was because of rumors and in those days because of bad medical treatment. And also there was a lot of doing things because it looked good, not on TV in those days, because it looked good to the public. And I think a lot of our fogging up neighborhoods and stuff like that is, you know, it has not controlled the mosquitoes anywhere yet, including in Miami. And I'm not sure how much of it is more for the TV cameras than it is for you know, it's a good public health measure. Yeah. In some cases, it's all we've got.
Right.
But it doesn't necessarily work.
You say all of these rumors have – it seems like they have characteristics to them. There's like one kernel of truth that makes it sound kind of credible, and then people jump on it. And it seems like these concerns sort of ideologically are right and left. They're sort of all over the map. And I wanted to go through some of these.
Mm-hmm.
One of the questions comes up about – there's this idea that microcephaly is linked to pesticides used to get rid of mosquitoes. What do you know about that?
Because of the dengue virus, which was really hitting Brazil hard, a lot of towns had piroxicam, which is a larvicide, put into any bit of standing water, including drinking water tanks. And in the shanty towns in Brazil, a lot of people live with a rainwater barrel attached to a pipe that leads to their roof. So when it rains, the water runs down the pipe and is stored in the barrel. So health inspectors would go around putting little bits of piroxicam in the barrels because the mosquitoes would grow in the barrels. It was standing water. It was a perfect environment for them. And so the rumor went around that the microcephaly was caused by this piroxicam. You can see why that would happen. People are afraid of any chemical. They're afraid of anything in the drinking water. But the truth is that there were towns that used other things like abate, temifos, and they would have microcephaly too, and there were towns where nothing was done, nothing was put into the water, and they still had microcephaly there. Also, piroxicam has been used in the United States for years. If you ever bought flea spray for your dog or a flea spray for your carpet, it may have had it in it. You know, babies have been crawling in it and putting their hands in their mouths for years, and it's basically a harmless chemical. It's a mimic of an insect hormone that tells the larval stage to stop growing. Humans and insects have very different signaling proteins in them because we devolved from each other so far back in evolution. And so an insect hormone doesn't necessarily send a signal to a human cell and vice versa.
Mm. Have you heard the one that it's about Roundup, that Roundup's causing all of this?
Yep. I heard that early on. You know, I mean, the obvious reason it's not Roundup is Roundup has been used since the 1970s. Millions and millions of acres have been sprayed with it, and there's never been an outbreak like this linked to it. This was not a particularly – you know, Roundup is something you use in agricultural areas, and this was an urban and particularly urban epidemic. And so you had lots and lots of people who lived in the favelas that didn't have any green space around and didn't have Roundup for miles around, and they were still getting microcephaly. So – that was pretty good evidence against every one of these things, although you can see because of people's irrational fears. They were also afraid that it was genetically modified mosquitoes.
Yeah.
And genetically modified mosquitoes were indeed being released in tests in Brazil. But the closest ones to the outbreak in Recife in northeast Brazil were in another town that was 1,700 miles away, which is about as far as I am from Bismarck, North Dakota.
Right.
And they were all male mosquitoes. Mm. And male mosquitoes don't bite people. They basically live to have sex and drop dead. We should all be so lucky, but that's what male mosquitoes do. So they didn't draw blood, and they can't infect anybody with anything. They live very briefly on flower nectar, and then they die.
Another there was a whole set of rumors you write about that blamed it on vaccines. Put that to bed, if you would.
It's you know, everything gets blamed on vaccines when something new comes along. I'm used to hearing that. You know, there's a very strong anti-vaccine movement in this country. It did not start with autism. The anti-vaccine movement started, you know, at least in 1796 when Edward Jenner took some pus out of a milkmaid's hand and stuck it in the arm of a little boy and then tested the boy a few weeks later to see if he got smallpox. And it worked. He didn't get smallpox. That was the era of modern vaccines. But people were horrified by the idea of taking disease and injecting it into a child. And so they rejected vaccine for many years starting in the 1800s. And lots of leading clerics and churchmen rejected it too. But anyway, the there's always an anti-vaccine movement. So you have to ask specifically, well, what vaccine are you talking about, and why would that vaccine cause a problem when it's never caused a problem before? And one rumor was that there was a bad batch of rubella vaccine, because rubella also causes microcephaly in cases. But there was no evidence there had been a bad batch of rubella vaccine 9 months before, because there had never been any outbreak of rubella in Brazil. The other rumor was that there had been a change in the diphtheria vaccine, in fact, the diphtheria component of what we now call DPT vaccines, or sometimes they have vaccines that have five vaccines in one shot. But that same switch from cellular to acellular pertussis had been made in the United States 15 years ago. It's actually a weaker vaccine. That's why part of the reason we've had a whooping cough outbreak in this country is because the vaccine is not as strong, and some people are having it wear off. But it has nothing to do with microcephaly. The reason it was switched is because in some cases it did cause seizures and high temperatures in kids, and that was a problem. So they decided to change the vaccine, but nothing to do with microcephaly. So. Mm. Those were, I think, pretty thoroughly debunked. The obvious one of the things I say in medical school is, look, when you hear hoofbeats behind you, think horses, not zebras, because it's usually a horse. Yeah. And, the Zika was the horse. It was the new thing. It was an unknown disease. Nobody had immune to it. Everybody was sick from it. Pregnant women were sick from it. And lo and behold, 6 to 9 months later, they started giving birth to babies with problems. Mm-hmm. That sort of is one of those cases where if it looks like a duck and it, walks like a duck and it quacks, it's probably a duck and not a zebra or a horse, to mix the metaphor. But the obvious explanation was probably the explanation.
So interesting, the kinds of reactions to all of this. There was a rumor that there wasn't a causal link between Zika and microcephaly in babies, which sort of leads to this. You write this entire chapter about, and this is the thing that really got you interested in this story, at least the one that was so striking for you at first, is that there were these public health experts in Brazil who were saying, in Brazil, mind you, saying you should delay, pregnant women, women should delay getting pregnant. And the reaction you write about from right-wing activists, progressive women's rights activists, to the idea of delaying pregnancy, I don't know, is really fascinating. Would you talk about that?
Sure. It wasn't just Brazil. It was a deputy health minister in Brazil suggested. Wait a minute, nobody's ordering women to do anything. This is health ministers saying basically they didn't want to admit it, but what they knew was this is out of control. We have no way of controlling it. We can't control the mosquitoes. They didn't want to say that because sometimes the people in charge of getting rid of the mosquitoes was the army. So they, you're a little shy about that. But, but it was very clear that there was nothing stopping the disease. It was spreading like mad everywhere it went. So the only thing they could offer women is to say, look, we think this disease spreads really fast, peaks and crashes and disappears. So if you could just please try not to be pregnant right now, you might save yourself a lifetime of misery, or not have a child who dies. And this struck me as actually pretty sensible advice. Nobody's asking women not to have children for the rest of their life. They're basically saying, look, please delay for one mosquito high transmission season if you can. The church, the Catholic Church, of course, immediately rejected this advice because, it implies that women ought to use contraception, and they've historically been against that. And, that was completely predictable and didn't make a lot of headlines. What really surprised me was that reproductive rights groups got just as angry and basically sided with the church without saying that. They said it's outrageous that anybody would ask women to delay pregnancy when these governments don't offer contraception or abortion to their to the women in the country. Well, they're right that it was outrageous that contraception and abortion were not easily available in those countries, but they were wrong that it was bad advice. In fact, it struck me as like, hey, this is the perfect wedge issue to use to kick the Catholic Church right in the cojones for 50 years of opposition, because many people are unsympathetic. Many Catholics are unsympathetic to teenage girls who want to, who have sex and then want to get rid of the baby. But they're fairly sympathetic to people who want to get rid of a baby because they realize the baby is going to suffer and die. And the mother is, if the baby lives, the mother is going to have an extremely difficult life. So And this actually historically happened in the United States, that in the 1964-65 rubella outbreak in the United States, when lots and lots, 20,000 children were born with birth defects in this country, and a lot of women went to have abortions. Now, be it said, they had not had amnio, they had not had ultrasounds, those things were invented, but they knew that they were pregnant and they knew they had German measles, rubella, so they went to doctors and asked for abortions. There's a whole article about it in Life magazine that I found, unfortunately, after I wrote the book, and it's got pictures of women in beehive hairdos sitting up in beds waiting to see the doctor because it's wrong to think that abortion was completely and totally legal everywhere in the United States before Roe v. Wade. It wasn't. It was a more complicated situation as it is in Latin America. That actually changed the abortion debate in this country. Four states passed laws saying that abortion was legal in the case of gross deformations to the fetus. So it actually drove the abortion debate forward. And I thought, why aren't these reproductive rights groups using that logic, trying to push the abortion debate forward in those countries using this issue? But instead, they rejected the whole idea of delaying pregnancy, saying it was an insult. And so it became the politically correct thing to say that this is outrageous. And it's been very hard. The CDC will not say we suggest that women delay pregnancy. They instead say delaying pregnancy is an extremely personal and deeply difficult decision, and we suggest that women talk to their healthcare providers about it. Meanwhile, in Puerto Rico, they are pushing massive amounts of birth control into Puerto Rico. IUDs, Nuva rings, birth control pills, lots of other things, which is a very good thing to do, but they're doing it kind of under the table through the CDC Foundation instead of announcing that they're doing it and saying, look, we really think women should try to use these goods and avoid pregnancy right now. It may be perfectly safe to have a baby next year, but this year is a real bad time to be pregnant.
What did you learn about the CDC? It seems like you start working on this story you write about. One of the things you wondered about really early on is why don't they issue a travel alert?
My objectivity.
Of course.
I've been kind of stunned by how slow the CDC has been to do a number of things in this epidemic. I was screaming at a poor spokesman for the CDC for 2 weeks because I had pregnant women calling me asking me. This is back in January. Mm-hmm. They were thinking of going to Puerto Rico or the Dominican Republic or someplace. That's the high visit the Caribbean season here in New York. And pregnant women were saying, what do you do? And I'm saying, you shouldn't be getting your medical advice from a reporter. I don't have a degree. I'm not a doctor. I have a degree in rhetoric. I kind of know what I'm talking about, but really you ought to get it from a doctor, and the CDC is giving no guidance. And I was screaming at poor Tom Skinner from the CDC saying, why aren't you guys holding a press conference and giving guidance? And it took them more than 2 weeks and long delays to do that. And then when it became clear that sexual transmission was a reality, it took quite a while for people to add that to the warning. So it was well after the Brits said maybe men should use condoms after they return from one of these areas. I think they kind of did that in response to my yelling at Tom Skinner because I said, when are you going to have an announcement? And he first said, we're working on it. We're not going to have one. And I blew up and said, this is ridiculous. The Brits are way ahead of you. And he called back and said, we'll have an announcement in an hour. And they did. Kind of garbled, weird CDC speak taken from syphilis language and stuff. But ultimately, they straightened it out and they've got a pretty sensible set of warnings now.
Yeah. But what's the reluctance? Is it abundant caution? Is it that they're worried about, destroying tourist economies? I mean, what is it?
I don't know. I mean, the CDC is never going to say that, we're bending to the tourism industry. They're never going to say we're bending to the governor of Florida or people from Florida. They do act out of an abundance of caution normally, and I think that's a very good thing.
Sure.
I mean, that is kind of the job of a public health agency. You want to make sure that none of your citizens get into danger. So if you become overcautious, okay, fine. Everybody's good. Why now they are not giving out a widespread travel advisory for a good chunk of southern Florida, why they are going along with the absurd fiction that mosquitoes will stay within a 1 square mile area or that people with a virus in their blood will stay within a 1 square mile area is beyond me. It seems to me fairly obvious, especially since we know that it takes 3 to 4 weeks between the time somebody is bitten and their case is detected, tested, and reported to the authorities. We know that the virus is being transmitted right now, and we're not going to find out where it's being transmitted for 3 weeks at least. If those, not only the areas where we know this transmission, but maybe pretty wide areas around those ought to be off limits for pregnant women. Obviously, again, advice, not orders, but I think the area of caution ought to be considerably wider than it is, especially since back in January when the CDC issued travel advisories, they said, stay away from the entire country of Mexico, stay away from the entire country of Colombia. And the Mexicans were screaming, hey, we've only got, you know, 20 cases in this one province here. We've got nothing in Mexico City and there's no mosquitoes because it's a mile high in the air. How can you bar pregnant women from coming to our country? And the CDC said, we're doing it out of an abundance of caution. I'd say, good. It's a good principle. Stick with it. Florida, too.
Donald McNeil, his book is Zika, The Emerging Epidemic. We'll take another quick break and come back for some final thoughts. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Donald G. McNeil, Jr. We're talking about his book, Zika, The Emerging Epidemic. Let's talk about the mosquito that transmits it, the Aedes aegypti. Did I get that right?
Yep. Aedes aegypti.
This is the so-called yellow fever mosquito. Where in the United States can you find a mosquito like this? It was once thought like maybe 12 states. You say it's something like 30 states have them?
Yeah, but it's not. I mean, that's when they went looking desperately trying to update their maps, which they hadn't updated since the beginning of the West Nile virus outbreak.
Right.
They looked for papers that had maybe spotted two or three mosquitoes in Connecticut at one point and said, okay, they're found in Connecticut. The truth is that the mosquitoes are concentrated heavily along the Florida Gulf Coast, along the Gulf Coast in general, basically from Florida over to Texas. And there's some of them on the Big Island of Hawaii. And those are the main areas. They kind of go up as far as southern Tennessee. Yes, they're found sometimes in very hot, wet summers for brief periods of time in little pieces of 30 states, I think almost as far as Minnesota and up to Connecticut here. But that doesn't mean that, you know, that you're, the mosquito that's landing on you is likely, if you're in New York City or Salt Lake City, is likely to be an Aedes aegypti. In fact, in Salt Lake City, you're really safe. My brother lives there. I don't think I've ever seen a mosquito around his house and, you know, pretty high up in the air. So you don't have a lot of dangerous mosquitoes.
But there is another mosquito type that might transmit it, the Asian tiger mosquito. What do we know about that?
Aedes albopictus.
Yeah.
We know from experience in Africa and Gabon that Aedes albopictus was responsible for one outbreak. It's been shown, but it doesn't seem to be happening. You know, we have not seen a big switchover from one mosquito to another. Mosquitoes, sometimes they can do things, but they don't. It's kind of it's a phenomenon of how quickly the virus gets from the mosquito's gut to the mosquito's salivary glands and what the mosquito's biting habits are. Aedes aegypti really like to bite people and nobody else, and they like to live as close to people as they can. They will breed in your garden. If they can get into your house and breed in an unused shower drain, they will do that. Whereas Aedes albopictus, you know, they're happy to bite you. They're happy to bite a deer. They're happy to bite a bird. They're kind of omnivores of the mosquito world for bloodsuckers. And so they don't focus on humans, and they also don't seem to build up as much virus and transmit it as easily as Aedes aegypti does. So far they have not become a factor in this epidemic.
I found it interesting. I wonder what you make of the case of the elderly man in Utah here who died with what is believed to be a virus.
A mystery.
Okay,
that guy had 100,000 times the normal viral level in his blood, and nobody knows why. You know, every epidemic has outliers that are unexplained, and that one is one of them. And how it was transmitted from the father to his son is still unknown. I mean, there are theories that if you have that much virus in your blood, it might have been transmitted in saliva or urine, something like that. But we may never know. I mean, it's clear that the virus exists in urine. You can actually – a urine test is actually better than a blood test for the virus, but because we don't normally transmit urine from one person to another – there aren't a lot of diseases that are in which urinary transmission is seen as a big factor. Good thing for kindergartens, but you know, that's just a reality. So that's an outlier case, and I do not know what to make of it. If there's more of them, maybe there'll be more study, but we'll see.
The sexual transmission part, there seems to be a lot we don't know. We don't know if a man can transmit this without symptoms. We don't know if a woman can transmit it. We don't know if there has to be blood and semen. Do we know any of that?
No, some of that's changed. That's all true from the book, but other things have happened since then. We definitely know that a man who's never had symptoms can transmit it. We know of one case where a woman has transmitted it to a man. It was an odd outlier of a case. She was having an extremely heavy period, and it might have been actually a blood to somehow transmission. we don't know how common sexual transmission is.
Yeah.
There's some really interesting data that shows that of women of childbearing age, which is to say the age of women having sex, four times as many women have the disease as men do. Now, that could mean that women are getting it from sex a lot more than women are getting it from mosquito bites. Or it could mean that women of childbearing age are simply tested a whole lot more. Women tend to go to the doctors more than men anyway under any circumstances, and pregnant women are much more likely to go to a doctor, and pregnant women in the course of an epidemic like this that's a threat to their child are extremely likely to go to a doctor. So the question is, how do you tease out the figures by removing the confounding factor of higher testing? So, but there are little hints that it might be sexually transmitted more often than we think.
You mentioned in the book we're at least probably about 2 years away from any kind of a vaccine, I suppose. You know, it was so interesting. You mentioned that this is sort of how you put it finally, with a kind of nod to empathy. The idea of being
alert. I'm a big believer in empathy.
Yeah. Would you say something about that? I found that really important.
Well, I mean, the problem is that when disease comes along, people get scared. And then they get scared and they get angry and they lash out. And the truth is the person who has the disease is just as scared or more scared as you are. And this notion that, you know, these people are bringing this disease to our neighborhood makes for very sad, very bad outcomes in a lot of cases. And the example I was giving in that case when I was talking about empathy was, you know, it's possible that this disease will disappear within a year or two and everybody will say, oh, the media blew it over again and it's not that important. And you know, people said that about swine flu in 2009. But I met a woman who had swine flu and she was in a coma for weeks and she lost her baby. She died four times and was revived during that time and she lost her baby during that time. She was a pregnant woman and all she had was flu and the only mitigating or unmitigating condition, the only dangerous medical condition she had was being a future mother. She was pregnant. And so I was, you know, I described how much she had suffered and how much she lost her baby and what a struggle she was having to come back just to be able to walk and to lift a 1 pound weight again because she had so wasted away during those months in the coma. And I, you know, ended the book by saying, look, you know, show empathy for people like that. It could be you.
Donald G. McNeil, Jr. His book is Zika, The Emerging Epidemic. Donald, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you very much.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.